Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Laura.
And I'm Amity. Let's get started. We're jumping into the third section of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. This part is called Christian Behavior. There are 12 chapters. And so our approach is going to be a little bit different from the others. We're just going to very, very briefly summarize, just tell you like the main points of the chapter and then tell you something that stood out to us, because otherwise this would go on for several hours. Yeah. So we're going to try to condense it that way. I mean, it may not be terribly long at all. But Christian behavior, there's a lot to it. And his thoughts are very deep and sometimes very complicated. And we've said before, like a lot of times you're reading along, you're like, yeah, this makes so much sense. But then you go to try to summarize it and you're like, I don't actually know how to say that any differently. I guess I'm not as smart as C.S. Lewis. That's fine.
So we're doing our best.
Only one of him.
Yes. So this whole book is about Christian behavior. This section of the book. For me, the first chapter was really interesting. So he talks about the three parts of morality. So morality is concerned with three things: the interactions between individuals, things inside each individual, and the purpose of human life as a whole. So those are the three things that morality is concerned with. This gave me a lot to think about. So most people say they're concerned with number one, like how we have interactions with each other. And I think that's mostly because it's outward. It's what we can see. It's what happens. And he says, but people don't mention number two or number three very much. He kind of asked the question, like, why is number two important, which is morality inside of ourselves? And then he dives deep into it. There's a couple of things I want to bring out about that. But at the end of the chapter, then it talks about when we're thinking about morality, we really have to think about all three of them. I thought this was a perfect explanation. Disagreements start with number two, but they get serious with number three. It's number three where the main differences are between Christians and non-Christians, the purpose of why we're here. I think there was a few questions he asked there with number three, but I just remember, like, why are we here? What are we doing? Those like questions that people ask about the purpose of life. Did you have anything in that chapter that stood out to you?
Yeah, there were just a couple of things. First of all, he talks about how important that second one is, harmonizing the things inside each individual. But he's like, nothing but the courage and unselfishness of individuals is ever going to make any system work properly. You cannot make men good by law, and without good men, you cannot have a good society. And this is something that I feel like we've been trying to talk about and put, you cannot legislate goodness. You cannot use government to force people to do good. But at the same time, you can legislate things to encourage people to be able to have more time with their families, to be able to encourage a little more self-awareness and things like that. And I think we live in a society where so much has been broken down because of the breakdown of the family unit and the fact that there is so much individual selfishness, and because there's all this, I don't know, there's just a lot of corruption. And so I don't know. I don't really know what the answer is, except that we need to get back to like people being individually good, having strong families and strong morals. Otherwise, the entire civilization breaks down. Another thing too, kind of along with that, he's like, there are a good many things which would not be worth bothering about if I were going to live only 70 years, but which I'd better bother about very seriously if I am going to live forever. He's like, if individuals live only 70 years, then a state or a nation or a civilization which may last for 1,000 years is more important than an individual. And we see throughout history where people do think that that is the case. And so it's fine to sacrifice people left and right, you know, because it's all about the country. It's all about the kingdom. But when you really understand, you believe that life is more than just here and now, the individual is more important than the entire civilization.
Yeah, that's one of the things I had, was that like when we think about life in terms of forever, it makes the individual the most important thing. I think that's a lot of why Christians have such a value on children and family. I really like that section. And the funny thing is, those are the two sections I had like highlighted. And what made me think about it, like what you quoted there, you cannot make men good by law. And without good men, you cannot have a good society. It reminded me of signs that say no weapons allowed.
Mm-hmm.
I laugh about that every time I see one. Okay.
Yeah.
Like I have these offices I work in Hillsboro, and there's like no weapons allowed signs on their thing. And I go, you know, if I was going to go in there with a gun and do something, that might stop me. I might stop and say, oh, wait, I was going to go in there and like hurt somebody, but there's a sign on the wall that
there's
says
a sign that says I can't. So I guess I won't.
I mean, it just makes you realize that like what's inside of somebody, no law, no like sign is going to change that. They're going to do what they're going to do.
I mean, cannot legislate goodness. Yeah.
We laugh. I've laughed about that so many times. And it's like the only thing that does is keep a good man or woman from taking a weapon in there and then not being able to defend themselves. That's exactly the only thing that does. So yeah. I just totally don't understand that. But like, we have to rely on what's inside of each individual.
And we have to understand that what's inside of them, as he's going to talk about later, it's not something we can control. They always have a choice. He talks about the raw material.
So the other thing I thought was interesting was he was talking about how people are afraid of moral rules and that some people like to call them moral ideals. How he described it was really just interesting about like, even though perfect behavior isn't possible. And he says that so many times in this, like we're going to make mistakes. It's not possible for us, even with chastity, which I thought was really interesting later. Mm-hmm. He says it's not possible to live moral chastity perfectly. So it's bad when some people say, or it's not a good idea when some people say that a man has high moral ideals, because that would mean he has his own ideas of moral perfection that the rest of us don't share. It's like a certain taste or a certain preference. That's just not how it works. Because, I mean, is he kind of saying like we all have the same goal?
Yeah, and like we should. And so I think that there are some people who do have these high moral ideals. They do kind of set themselves apart, but that's not in line with the actual Christian way of believing and acting. Because he says also, it might lead you to become a prig and to think you are rather a special person who deserved to be congratulated on his idealism. And so you are going to start like judging people and thinking that you're so much better because you've come up with what you think are the high moral ways to be. And it's not necessarily in line with the Christian way of living.
Yeah. He's like, if you are thinking this, so then you think you're a special person who deserves praise for your idealism. But since we can't be perfect and we're always going to make mistakes, we're just being congratulated on trying, just like everybody else. We're just back to where everybody else was.
Right. Ultimately. Yeah.
Yeah, I said, isn't this what we're all trying to do? And therefore, we aren't special. So that's why when you talk about him in terms of, well, he says in terms of rules rather than ideals.
Chapter two, like I said, I mean, super brief summary. It's called the cardinal virtues. And he talks about how there are seven virtues, the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues. He's only going to address the cardinal ones because cardinal means pivotal, not to be confused with like cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church. So the cardinal virtues are prudence, which is just practical common sense, temperance, which is going the right length, but no further. And he's writing this at a time when they've just kind of, they're pretty much coming out of prohibition. And so he's like, it's not that. It applies to like everything. It's going just the right length, but no further. And he's like, we've basically found prohibition does not work. So you need temperance, not prohibition. Justice is the third virtue, which is honesty and keeping promises, give and take, and truthfulness, and also fortitude, which is like the combination of the two kinds of courage, which he defines as the kind that faces danger, as well as the kind that sticks it under pain. In other words, you've got guts. A virtuous person has developed muscle memory, and this is how they are all the time. So it's not somebody who just by chance is really, really good one time. There's somebody who is like trying all the time. Like you can recognize a virtuous person because that's how they are. He compares it to like somebody who's really, really good at any athletic event. Maybe they're a really good baseball player. Like they're always going to be steady. He says tennis in here. I'm going to say baseball because they're always steady. You can always depend on them doing well out in the field, doing pretty well at the plate. And it's in the way that they train and the way they carry themselves. Like, they may have some random person who's really not good at baseball may get up and they may hit a home run. Okay, but they're not consistent in anything else. You cannot depend on them in any other way. And so he just talks about how a truly virtuous and good person is somebody that can be depended on. They're always trying to be their best. And like you said, and like he keeps saying, nobody can ever be perfect, but they have developed in such a way that you can always depend that they are always trying and they're very consistent.
I loved his example of the sports thing because it's like, yeah, I could totally relate to it. I'll say I'm playing volleyball. Very occasionally I can do something great, but like not consistently.
Right. And that is what sets apart a pro athlete or a college athlete from just like a recreational athlete is like, you know, recreational athletes, they get out there and they do just fine. But it's the consistency, consistently doing the right thing, consistently making good choices on the sports field. Even if they make mistakes, of course, they're going to make mistakes, but they are ultimately very consistent. Now, he says that this matters for three reasons. The first is that right actions done for the wrong reason do not help to build the internal quality or character called a virtue. And it is this quality or character that really matters. It is all about your attitude. You can't just be doing things just because somebody is forcing you to. You can't be doing things grudgingly. You need to be doing them for the right reasons. And that is what develops you as a virtuous person. Number two, he says, we might think that God wanted simply obedience to a set of rules, whereas he really wants people of a particular sort. So we are trying to change our very nature. And number three, we might think that the virtues were necessary only for this present life, but the truth is that they are necessary for all of eternity.
We might think these virtues are just for this life, but there will be every occasion for being the sort of people that we can become only as a result of doing such acts here. And I thought a lot of what we hear from our church leaders is about that becoming. A lot of people, I believe, get stuck in the like, I'm supposed to be doing this and this and this and this every day. I think by doing those things, you do become something. But like, sometimes we get so focused on those little things that we're missing the whole point of what the goal is. I just, in Sunday school today, we kind of had a discussion that was like, I almost said something about it because I was like, I just read this in Mere Christianity, but why are we doing all these things? Because we're trying to change something in us. There has to be like a point to it all. And I think that's the point to it all. And then the other thing I liked was he said, an individual Christian may see fit to give up a number of things, but the moment he starts saying the things are bad in themselves or looking down his nose at other people who do use them, he's taken the wrong, I think this is funny, he's taken the wrong turning. Google Docs did not like that word. Turning. It was like, he has, sometimes he has some interesting ways of wording
it's things. Very British. I love it.
That, I think, as Christians is a hard thing for us, and maybe not hard for some of us all the time, but like we kind of slip into it, or other people might think that we think this. If there's something that we abstain from or whatever, that we look down on other people who don't abstain from it. And so I think that's like a kind of a tricky hole that we can get in, and we have to be careful not to judge others.
Yeah, absolutely. That just because one person has decided to abstain from something, it does not make the thing bad. And so they can't turn around and expect everybody else to. If somebody decides that they're going to be vegetarian and abstain from eating any meat, it doesn't mean that eating meat is bad and that other people who eat meat are doing something wrong. That's just something that person has chosen not to do. It made me think about, okay, I love stilettos. Okay. Love them. And I think they're so pretty. I think they're so pretty. Like, I love to wear them. I totally do. I was in church one time and this girl, she complimented me on the stilettos, but at the same time, she was like, my husband would never want me to wear those because they're way too sensual. And I was like, okay, well, good for you. Just because you're choosing not to, that is not going to affect what I choose to do with my shoes at all.
Their shoes.
Their shoes.
But another person I know likes to wear fishnet stockings. Is that what they're called? Like, they're like nylons that have like a, I don't know, like a pattern. Like the
fishnet pattern.
Yeah, to church. A person a male that was at church complained about it.
Oh my gosh.
That it was like you said, what was the word you used? It was sensual or something
sensual.
Like that. And like, oh my gosh. I mean, that's your problem. The
that
fact
is
that you
it's
can't
completely his
keep
problem.
Your mind out of the gutter. Like, I don't like fishnet stuff. Like, I don't like nylons. And so I don't wear them. But like, I don't judge. Like, if somebody else wants to wear them,
like,
they're
who
not.
Even notices? I mean, whatever.
I would break my ankle, though, if I wore stilettos. And then I'd be taller than my husband. So that would also.
Well, there is that. And like, sometimes I am taller than my husband when I wear them. But I don't care because I love them. They're so fun. I have some pretty high heels, but I don't know if they would qualify as stilettos at this point.
How tall would you wear?
I don't know. I've never like measured them. I like the ones that are just really well built. They have a pretty shape in the shoe and then like the heel. And I don't know. There's just something. I don't like leopard print or something. I usually like just the
That's
solid
hilarious.
Color, like a pretty black heel or something. Anyway.
And I wear flip-flops. And like, if it's cold out, break out the boots.
Which is great. Again, like just because somebody chooses to wear something or not wear something, it doesn't matter what somebody else chooses.
Yes.
Like, it is so far be it from any of us to like try to impose what we're doing on somebody else.
For me, we might let our kids do a certain thing. Like, watch a certain thing, or my husband and I watch something that maybe another family wouldn't, or maybe we eat stuff that another family wouldn't. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to not think that the other person is judging me.
Yeah, same.
And so I think we have to be careful on both sides, right? Like that we're not judging other people. And then we're like, wait, that standard that they have for them, that's for them. And that's great if that's what they need. How dare you have those higher standards than we have? It's ridiculous.
Well, and who's to say that they're necessarily higher standards? Maybe it's a way of thinking about it, you know?
True.
Like they're not necessarily higher. It's just different.
Yeah, that's so true. So yeah, we just have to be careful and realize like,
wait,
we all make our own choices. And nobody tells us exactly what we need to do or exactly what we need to abstain from. It's our own choice.
And these opinions that run rampant, you just kind of have to shut them out. Because along the same lines as the stiletto thing, there was a lady who had very heavy opinions. No, she was just very opinionated about your footwear to church in general. She, and this is a different lady completely. But what's surprising is she actually lived in Oregon, not where you guys live. She was like, no, you should wear stockings. And you should wear closed toe shoes. And even if your heel, if you have, it should just be like a slight heel, but it should not be open toed at all. You know?
Wow.
And it was like, what? And like any kind of sandal is inappropriate for, like, honey, you are making this way too complicated. But she was not alone in that. Like there's this whole sort of subsection of people who like really think that way. You need to get a life if you are like so have so much time as to worry about what people are wearing on their feet and legs to church. Who wants to wear stockings ever?
Like, never.
Okay, every once in a while I do when it's like really cold and if it's something that works with my outfit, but no,
I don't even own them.
Yeah, I didn't until just like a couple years ago.
I heard this story recently, though, of this girl that converted. Somebody at church said something to her about her skirts being too short. Maybe this was like recent. You may have heard it, too. I don't know where I heard it. Mm-hmm. She said to the people, she said, well, I've been converted and I have a testimony of Jesus Christ, but my skirts just haven't caught up with it yet. I thought that was funny.
That was a good response. Like, I think I would have followed it up with just, and also worry about yourself.
Yes. Chapter 3 is about social morality. And this chapter is all about the golden rule. And he says it really funny. Like, because what would we learn? I mean, I learned it as do unto others as you would have done unto you. But he says, do as you would be done by. That's really
funny. I know.
Funny.
Yeah.
But it's true. It works. It must be British. That must be like.
I know.
Do as you would be done by. So basically, he says there's no instructions for how to build a Christian society, and it's not meant to replace an ordinary society. And then he kind of goes into like the idea that some people think that priests and other religious leaders should become political leaders. And he's like, no, that's not their job. They need to keep authors need to write books. You know, teachers need to teach. So they need to stay where they are. And then he talks about if we had a truly Christian society, I thought this was interesting. It would be economically socialistic and old-fashioned. in its code of behavior and family life. Then he goes into the idea of charity being a major part of Christian morality. And he says that we should give more than we can spare, which I thought was interesting. He kind of even goes into like, if you're spending money on luxuries, you're not living the Christian life. Like, you need to give that away. And he said that he thinks that this section is going to upset everybody. Both sides of the aisle are going to be mad about, like, he should have said this or he shouldn't have said that. And he says this, perhaps this is because people look to Christianity for a confirmation of their political beliefs rather than for real political instruction. If we are to improve society, we must begin by turning inward to our own souls rather than trying to influence other people's actions. Kind of goes back to the last chapter about like what's going on inside of us. And I like what you said, worry about yourself. What's going on inside of you before you start trying to tell everybody else how to live, even in politics. One thing he says that I thought was funny was that you will find this again and again about anything that is really Christian. Everyone is attracted by bits of it and wants to pick out those bits and leave the rest. So I think that goes back to like the whole judging stuff is like, they kind of pick what they want to, what standards they want to hold to, and then they want to hold them, everybody else to them. But then there are these other things over here.
Yeah. And he even says people who are fighting for quite opposite things can both say they're fighting for Christianity. And that's kind of very telling. It's like, okay, so they've chosen the things that they think are the most important and they've decided the other people are wrong. But in reality, they're both wrong. If they have decided on one thing that is most important, they're like taking their bits and pieces. And then if they're fighting over it, hello, not Christian.
The one last thing I had was, I may repeat, I think this is the very end. Do as you would be done by till I am black in the face, but I cannot really carry it out until I love my neighbor as myself. And I cannot learn to love my neighbor as myself till I learn to love God. And I cannot learn to love God except by learning to obey him. That is profound.
Yeah, I loved that.
And I think that kind of goes back into the like how we treat other people. It actually starts with what's going on inside of us. So the number two thing that he talked about in chapter one is the most important thing. So what's going on inside?
A couple of things that I had, he talked about what a fully Christian society would be like. And number one would be no passengers or parasites. If man does not work, he ought not to eat. Number two, everyone's work is to produce something good. So everyone should work with their own hands and your work should produce something good. And thirdly, it is to be a cheerful society full of singing and rejoicing regarding worry or anxiety and regarding worry or anxiety as wrong. And it says the New Testament hates what it calls busybodies. Chapter four is called Morality and Psychoanalysis. He talks a bit about psychologists such as Jung and Freud. That's kind of interesting. I'm not going to talk a lot about that. Basically what he's saying in this chapter, actually what I am gathering from this entire book so far is what he's really telling us is to stop judging. That's really what I'm pulling, is that this is such a personal journey for us. We have no place to judge anybody. And in this chapter, I really feel like he's talking about how as long as we're making these choices that are drawing us, our center slightly closer to heaven, then we're doing good. He talks about raw material. Sometimes their raw material is a little messier than others. A lot of times those people with the raw material that is more messy than others, they didn't have a lot of choice in that. Sometimes it's their upbringing. Sometimes it's some physical limitations. Sometimes it's hormones or whatever. But as long as they're like trying to make choices that will progress them a little closer to God, that is the important thing. Maybe there's people who like have all the best upbringing, all the best genes, everything's great. But even with all that perfect setting, they're making bad choices. So they're actually doing worse than maybe these people who are like doing drugs and on the streets, but they see how rough their life is and they're trying to improve it incrementally, you know, little bit by little bit. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
What I wrote was, he said, human beings judge one another by their external actions. God judges them by their moral choices. He says, when a man who has been perverted from his youth and taught that cruelty is the right thing, does some tiny little kindness or refrains from some cruelty he might have committed and thereby perhaps risks being sneered at by his companions, he may, in God's eyes, be doing more than you and I would do if we gave up life itself for a friend. It's all very relative. Maybe there's somebody who's like in a gang and they're doing all kinds of illegal things and not good things all the time, but they have this spark all of a sudden and they do this tiny good thing. They like, I have no idea, just something small that's good and moral and a good choice. And it kind of makes everybody in their gang like question, like, what are you doing? Why would you do that? But that could be a braver step, a more drastic thing for them in that situation than somebody else who's in a much softer situation. They're in an environment that's much more conducive to doing good things. It makes me think of like the widow's mite. And maybe that's really what that story is all about, is like when you know, giving a tiny bit when all you have is a tiny bit is much greater than the person who gives lots when they have so much more at home.
God can see inside of us.
Right.
And so he knows what we have. He knows what our intentions are. So he judges us based on that. The reason we're told not to judge is because the only thing we have to judge on is external evidence. It just reminds me of my daughter had this friend when she was in another state. This friend did very strange things. She wasn't terribly upset with it, but one of her friends was really upset with it and like couldn't handle it and was mean to this person and stuff. Well, months later, it comes out in the national news how this person had been raised, and like he'd been seeing this counselor that was like brainwashing, and like it all made sense then. And so it was like we almost got this little window into a soul. And that happens sometimes where you're like, oh, this is what is going on, or this, you know, we just don't know what's going on in their heads. I like the saying that's like, if you thought what they thought, you would do what they did.
That's really good. Like, so hold up.
He says, this is why Christians are told not to judge. We see only the results which a man's choices make out of his raw material. We only see the external stuff. But God does not judge him on his raw material at all, but on what he has done with it. The idea of like where much is given, much is expected, you know, yeah, or required, I guess. Where much is given, much is required. Because he knows what we've been given.
It also kind of goes back to the parable of the talents. It's like the one with 10 talents went and doubled it. Okay, that's awesome. And then they were given more. And the person with one talent went and buried it. And so they didn't get any at all. But if they had taken that one talent and just done something with it, then that's all that was needed. It didn't matter how much everybody had. They just needed to do something with it.
Yeah, I like at the end of this section where he talks about like, it's just all about trying. It reminds me of like celebrities that donate all this money. That's great. And it sounds amazing and huge, like the widow's mite. If somebody who doesn't have money gives somebody else some tiny amount, that's just as good as this person who has
sometimes greater. If you look at it as a percentage, then it's actually often greater.
There's a little quote in there. I'm not going to read it because it's kind of long, but talks about like the whole idea is, what are we becoming?
Are we trying to turn our central creature towards God or away from him?
That's the quote I had, but it's big. Yes,
it is.
So yeah, it's all about becoming, you know, something that is huge effort for one person and not huge effort for another, that turns that person into becoming more like God more.
Yeah.
Sexual morality.
Yes.
All righty. I thought this was interesting that he said, I think of myself as being able to follow this, does he call it a commandment of virtue? I don't. Yeah. He calls it a virtue perfectly. Like, I feel like I do. He says you can't. And I think that's really interesting because I'm kind of thinking of it as like a black and white thing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm faithful to my husband, but I think of like little things that might come into not my mind, but like things I listen to or things I watch. Those little things, I think, are how you don't follow it perfectly. Mm-hmm. Chastity is the most unpopular of all virtues, he says. Yeah. And then he kind of talks about like our innate sexual instincts. So he says that either our innate sexual instincts are wrong or Christianity itself is wrong. He claims that our instincts are wrong. If healthy young people were to follow their sexual instincts without any caution, they'd produce enough children to populate a village. This is true. So for practical purposes alone, there has to be some kind of like prohibition, I think is what the word he used, on sexuality. We can't just be procreating constantly. That would just be ridiculous because who would take care of them?
Yeah.
And so, oh, I loved this too. I thought this was very interesting. He talks about a striptease, but he places food in there. People say that sex instinct is normal, but the problem is when we permit it and normalize it, then nothing gets better. So like he talks about this food, and if people are like watching them unveil some food like you would in a striptease, it doesn't make people not want to eat. it almost makes it worse.
He talks about how if that was the normal thing in a town or a city, you would think that there was a serious problem in that city.
They're starving.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they kind of
getting off on watching a food be unveiled.
You know, and some people think that that's the problem, that if we normalize it, it will make it everywhere, sex everywhere. Mm-hmm. It would make people not need it. That's the problem, is that they're starving, but that's not the problem. Even if sex isn't evil, there's a problem with how we treat it in our society. Even though Christianity is portrayed as sexual morality being one of the main features of our religion, it isn't. People without sexual sin can be even more sinful than people that is one of their sins that they partake in. So anyways, I thought that was just an interesting chapter. What I think is interesting about this book is it's different ways of thinking about all these things. A lot of these ideas I've never thought of before.
That's really, really true. And the way that he just like takes this general idea that maybe we have thought of and just like breaks it down to where you're like, holy moly, I hadn't thought about it that deeply, like not even close. And I feel like a total idiot.
As I was reading this book, I was thinking about how has our society made sex so out there? Sitcoms are constantly joking about it.
Yeah.
Constantly. Like you can't watch a sitcom without a sexual joke, I don't think. Even like family ones. We watched this movie last night on Netflix. It was a kid's movie, like a cartoon with Adam Sandler and Bill Burr as the voices. And I was like, I could not believe the jokes. I was like, this is a kid's show. I mean, Presley watched it with us and she totally didn't get them. But you can't watch a show on TV without having that in your face.
Yeah. It's all the time. And I think, admittedly, I haven't watched like anything in a long time. But even a few years ago, it seemed like movies that were supposed to be for teens, they would have that. And it was normal in high school for these kids to just be like having sex. And I think that's kind of awful when that's what our kids are watching and going, oh, well, okay. So I have this instinct. I'm discovering this about myself and I'm discovering that I'm super attracted to these people and this is okay. This is fine. I was also thinking many years ago, my cousin used to be married to this woman who was from Michigan and she had brought her cousin to visit us from Michigan. Her cousin was 14 years old and she was hanging out with my younger sisters who were about that age. You know, one of them was maybe 13 and the other one was like 10 or something around there, 11 and 14, something like that. I overhear their conversation and this 14-year-old girl is like, you guys haven't had sex? Are you kidding? Like, what's wrong with you? I'm serious. And this girl was 13 or 14. Yeah. She's like, y'all are virgins. And my sisters are like, yeah. What were you talking about?
And also that this problem that we have has obviously been like with sex being out there has been since the
40s. I mean, he was doing these presentations in the 40s during World War II. So. And then I think he put it into a book, was it in the 50s or whatever, but still, I know you don't think of that time as being very promiscuous, but it totally was.
Well, and it just makes you realize a lot of times we think things are worse now, but I do think like when we go back and look at teen movies in the 80s, they were pretty bad. So like, I think this has always been a problem.
Yeah. We just probably get a lot more aware of it as parents, especially.
Yeah.
But I do think, I don't know, there's still, do you think it's gotten a lot more like graphic and very like in your face? But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
And I do find that it's become more acceptable. So, you know, 10 years ago, maybe when Netflix first came out or like streaming or whatever, I would hear about a show and I would think, oh, you know what? That show sounds really good. I want to watch it. And I would watch the first episode and like, or my husband and I would watch it together. Sometimes I'd watch it by myself at home during the day or something. And I'd be like, I can't watch this. Maybe the F word or there's sex in it or something. Guess what? I now will watch stuff like that. I believe that we've become desensitized to it.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. Absolutely.
I look at myself, like one of the shows I remember is we heard that Breaking Bad was really good. And so we watched the first episode probably 10 years ago and we both were like, no, we can't watch this. Guess what? We've watched it now. Admittedly, the first episode was the worst.
Oh, okay.
So, like once you got past that, it was fine. But like, just because it's so hard to find shows that don't have that stuff in them. And it's like slowly we got desensitized to them.
Oh yeah, very much so. It's almost like it was calculated or something.
Yes.
So chapter 6 is called Christian Marriage. And at first he's like, I shouldn't talk about this because I'm not married, but the Christian doctrines on the subject are also very unpopular. He says, I feel I can hardly leave the subject out in an account of Christian morals. So basically he says men and women were made to be together and the promise they make at marriage should supersede all other desires. He's like, you don't make a promise intending to break it. And so no matter what happens, you should really try not to break that promise, you know, even if you quote unquote fall out of love or whatever, you still keep the promise because the kind of love that you should be having later on is not the same that you started with anyway. He said the feeling of being in love changes to a more quiet form of love. This is another thing he talked about, is that marriage ought not to be governed by the church over all citizens. There should be sort of that separation of church and state. There should be state rules over marriage and church rules over marriage. Because really, like, all you do is run into problems when you have the government completely having all say over marriage or the church having all say over marriage. So there needs to be like this separation. So that is an extremely brief summary from this chapter. So yeah, what were a couple of things that stood out to you? And then
I liked that idea that like you get married feeling one way and that feeling can't last forever. Or maybe you don't, I don't know, in the beginning of a relationship.
It can't because you would never get anything done.
No.
You would never be an effective human.
Yeah. I look at like when my husband and I were engaged or just dating and stuff. And it's like, I could never do what I do now if I was in that state, because that's all I thought about was him. We did the things we had to do. But other than that, we just kind of like hung out. Right. The idea that being in love is the only reason for remaining married really leaves no room for marriage as a contract or a promise at all. And so I think that we don't understand that when we go into marriage. You just don't believe that those feelings are going to change. But then what if they do? I guess the test is when the feelings change and you decide, wait a second, I promised this and I need to hold up my promise. Promise must be about things I can do, about actions. No one can promise to go on feeling in a certain way. I really believe that saying or that idea that you can love anybody. You can make a marriage with anybody work. It's all in how you approach it. And like, I don't know, we have control.
And there does have to be buy-in from both sides.
Well, yes.
For sure. Right. But yes.
But like, maybe you're not, I don't know. I'm trying to think like, maybe you're not attracted to somebody anymore or something, but you can make it work. It just makes me think, I know I said this like a year ago, but I'll bring up sister wives anytime I can. But so this man married these women and in the beginnings tried to show how everything's like how polygamy for them was normal. He wanted to normalize it for the world. Like we have a great family, right? Well, here we are in 2023, like 13 years later, and three of the wives have left and he's left with one wife. And he's saying, I never loved them.
Oh,
what have you been telling us for 13 years? Yeah. And now he's like, no, you know, I didn't vet the wives before they came into the family. I didn't really love them. And I'm like, you could have made it work. So that's my opinion.
Well, I don't know much about the show. I watched like, I think a couple of episodes when it first came out. So was that in 2010?
Something like that. Yeah.
Holy moly. But just some things that I've heard and read since then. He's like an awful person.
Yes.
Like a really awful person. So not exactly this paragon of what we should look for in marriage.
No, but in the beginning he seemed like a nice, normal guy.
That's what he was trying to portray for sure.
Okay. You made that mistake and you brought these women in having not fallen in love with them, having not vetted them. You could have been the better person and like made it work.
Yes. And also, I don't know if I believe him.
No, I don't.
I think he's lying.
Yeah.
Honestly.
No, I totally don't believe him. I could go on and on for hours. I think my sister and I need to have our own podcast about sister wives, but like,
I think that you should. I think you should.
It's crazy. But we'll call each other after the episodes air and talk for like 2 hours. But it's he says now that he didn't love them and he's mad at them for leaving. But you didn't love them. That's what
you left. He's such a liar. He's just trying to save face. Good grief.
I know. Anyways, so that's
what. Is it Amanda or Emily that you guys?
Emily.
Is it?
Amanda can't stand it.
Okay. A couple of points I did want to bring up from this chapter. First of all, he says, love is not merely a feeling. love as distinct from being in love is not merely a feeling. It is a deep unity maintained by the will and deliberately strengthened by habit, reinforced by the grace which both partners ask and receive from God. So again, it does have to be this effort given by both people. You have to keep working at it. And so that there's this deeper love. It's not that sort of titillating sense of being in love, but a deep love. And then the second thing is that I thought was really interesting. He talked about, again, sort of that thrill of being in love. You can't do that all the time. He said, thrills come at the beginning and do not last. He talks about when you first learn to fly an airplane, like there's this thrill of learning to fly the airplane. But after that, like if you're going to be a pilot, you have to keep flying even after the thrill is gone. Right? You have to stay with it if you're going to be a pilot. Otherwise, you're just going to jump from one thing to the next. Or like when you first start traveling, you see this beautiful place. You're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And you have that thrill of travel and seeing gorgeous views. So after that thrill has kind of worn off, do you just stop traveling? Do you stop appreciating beautiful things? No, you keep doing it. But he says, it is just the people who are ready to submit to the loss of the thrill and settle down to the sober interest who are then most likely to meet new thrills in some quite different direction. So it's like we actually all do need these things that like keep us alive and keep us going. You know, what I've heard a lot is when people have affairs, their biggest thing that they'll say is, I just wanted to feel alive. Okay, but the thing is, like, first of all, within your relationship, you should be doing things to help each other feel alive, but also do things in your life outside of that, that like keep you feeling alive, whether it's like, so that you're always growing, because probably essentially what it means is that when we find something that gives us that thrill, it means that we're progressing in some way, you know, whether it's learning to fly, or maybe you're like, suddenly have this passion for gardening and you get really good at gardening and you keep gardening, that means that you're progressing and you're getting better. Or like, so then that kind of gets on sort of this normal part of your life and you maybe don't have a thrill out of it anymore, but it's something that's good and healthy and you keep doing it. And then you find something else, like maybe it's like teaching people how to read or like, or just reading or starting a podcast or whatever. So I think the main thing is like always challenging yourself and learning and growing. And those things help your marriage too. Help your marriage stay healthy and help you stay healthy. So it never just like is stagnant. But I think both partners have to be doing that. Because as both partners are doing that, they're both have this aliveness about them. And that helps their partnership as well. I don't know. Does that kind of make sense?
Having an affair isn't the only way to feel alive.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And we have to keep growing and learning and having excitement in our life. Just doesn't mean we have to do that.
So. Right. Right. But again, maybe it kind of goes back to the last chapter in that that seems to be what's in our face all the time. And so people are like, oh, well, that's what I should do to feel alive. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's not the only option. I liked that. And I think like when I look at our marriage, when you're in that titillating, thrilling part, you can't love each other the way like we love each other in such a deeper way now than we did then. I think it's what gets us to get married.
Yeah. Even begin. Yes, absolutely.
Like it can't be sustained, and it just gets, and he does say that it gets better. Like you're going to find a better, deeper, more thrilling thing later once that's passed. So chapter 7 is about forgiveness. Like you said, chapter 7 through 12, the 7 to the end is like one thing after another. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. This is amazing. I'd never thought of this before. Everybody thinks that forgiveness is a lovely idea until it's their turn to forgive somebody. This is true. And then he talks about how like the Bible says, if we don't forgive, then we will not be forgiven. For us to be forgiven, that's the only thing that's expected, is that we will forgive others, period. But he says, since this is such a hard thing to do, what should we do? The first thing he says is start with the easy stuff. So start forgiving our families before we start with our enemies.
Yeah. Yeah. And our families, just the little things, just little things, practice little things.
Yes. Like something they said, let it. My mom listened to a podcast by Mel Robbins recently, and she keeps saying, let them, just let them. That's like her new like mantras, just let them.
I love it.
I'm going to look up that podcast and watch it. Yeah. Or listen to it. So start with the easy stuff. Second, the commandment that we're supposed to love our neighbors as ourselves. And then he says, well, what does loving your neighbor even mean? And then how do you even love yourself? I remember like learning about coaching and thinking like, well, you just need to love yourself. And I'm like, how do I do that? I don't understand, because I mean, I needed like concrete things to do. To love myself.
Yeah.
Like I can't just say, okay, I love myself now. So we kind of look at forgiveness as like looking at ourselves. We can hate the things we do, but we still love ourselves. Just like we can hate somebody else's things that they do, but not hate the person. Kind of the idea of like hate the sin, but not the sinner, or yeah. Love the sinner, hate the sin. I don't know what the exact words are, but he says, this is exactly how we do treat ourselves. Okay. And then I wrote this. I think what he is saying is that what really matters is how we feel inside. We shouldn't enjoy watching other people hurt or try to get back at them. This is a quote. Something inside us, the feeling of resentment, the feeling that wants to get one's own back, must simply be killed. That idea that we want other people to suffer. I think what he's saying is when we have intention, like we want good for other people, that's when we know we've forgiven. Somebody does something to me, I'm so mad. You can be mad about the thing they did, but like the minute it turns to, I want you to hurt, I want to get back at you, that's where the problem is. And he says, every time it bobs its head up, day after day, year after year, all our lives long, we must hit it on the head. Even as we kill and punish, we must try and feel about the enemy as we feel about ourselves, to wish that he were not bad, to hope that he may, in this world or another, be cured. In fact, to wish his good. And then he says, his last point is, this is exactly how God loves you. Fascinating.
I loved it. This was very, very helpful for me, because forgiveness is one of these things that I'm like, okay, but how? And I feel like he makes it pretty clear if we can get to this point where, you know what? Because in a lot of ways, he gives us a lot more base than I thought that we got. Because when he's like, you sometimes hate the things that you do in yourself, you do want yourself to ultimately succeed, right? Yeah. Like you still keep taking care of yourself and you still keep, you know, trying. So that's what you can do for your neighbor, or for anybody who has done you wrong, is like, you can absolutely like loathe some of the things they've done and said. Absolutely. When it comes down to it, you want them to succeed. I mean, you basically said that, but I just have to say that out loud again, because it's like, that is what forgiveness is. And you can also see how not forgiving somebody just turns you into kind of a monster. If you're like actually wishing bad things on somebody, like imagining these horrible things happening to them, what is that doing to you as a person? Just like weighing you down so much?
I think that's a really good check in for us. If you're ever wishing ill will towards someone, this is a clue that something is going on inside of us. Like something is wrong.
It is a good self-check, because in one moment I can be like, no, I wouldn't want anything bad to happen to that person that I've thought I was having a hard time forgiving. But then again, I don't know if I want them to succeed either.
Because I don't think I would wish real ill will towards anybody. But yeah. Anyways, I just thought this chapter was amazing.
First of all, at the beginning, when it talks about, everyone says forgiveness is a lovely idea until they have something to forgive, as we had during the war. And even sometimes, like when he says, and then to mention the subject at all is to be greeted with howls of anger, because people sometimes get angry at the people who are trying to forgive. They're like, how could you forgive that? You know, it's almost like you have suddenly done something wrong, or like you're complicit in what these people did if you're trying to forgive. And I was thinking about Corrie Ten Boom, the author of The Hiding Place, and her real life experience of, you know, she was taken to a concentration camp and her sister died there, and she barely escaped death. Like there was a mistake that kept her from being killed. She saw so much, and she and her family, and her father died in the concentration camps as well. And she and her family were just, they were hiding Jews. Like they were just trying to help. And it was just awful, everything that she endured. But she was talking about this love and forgiveness at sort of a convention or something. And afterwards, a Nazi soldier who I think had been in the camps with her came up and wanted to shake her hand. And she said that that was the moment that her forgiveness was actually tested, you know? And it was like, do I believe everything that I've said or do I not? And she like reached out and shook his hand. Yeah, I think that it can be done. And I think that
that's an amazing example.
It is. it's an amazing example, because you can talk about it all day long, but when it's staring you right in the face, then what do you do? And she did it. That was amazing.
I think of, like, say, I've heard of a man whose whole family was killed in a car accident. And then he, like, he goes and speaks up for the person who was drunk when they hit them, or you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. And then the last thing really quickly is when he says, does loving your enemy mean not punishing him? Like, not letting justice happen. Like, there was the woman, you know, there were these teens who thought it would be a good idea to throw a frozen turkey off an overpass, and it hit this woman's car, went through her windshield, and it just completely maimed her. She had to have hundreds of surgeries to, like, reconstruct her face and all these things. And they wanted to throw these kids away for life. And she is somebody who did. She went and, like, spoke in their behalf, and she forgave them. And she was like, I don't want this to ruin their life. There did have to be justice done. Like, they had to pay for everything, and they had to spend some time in jail, but she didn't want it to, like, completely, you know, to come out of jail when they're, like, 50. I think that there was this balance of justice and mercy. But he's like, look, you yourself cannot live with yourself. If you commit murder and you're a real Christian, you would go turn yourself into the authorities to be hung, which I guess is something they did in the 40s. They don't really do that as much now. And so he's like, you would want justice to be done because you can't live with yourself. And the same is true. Like, if other people do really bad things, justice does need to happen. And that's not loving them less. Such a big chapter. I wrote a very brief summary, but chapter 8 is called The Great Sin. He says, I now come to that part of Christian morals where they differ most sharply from all other morals. And he talks about this vice. And the great sin, this vice, is pride or self-conceit. It is the utmost evil. It's the worst one because it is competitive. It is always competitive. Somebody with pride is always wanting to be better, always wanting to be more. It's never enough, never enough. There's somebody who wants power. He talks about, you could be the richest person in the room, but first of all, you'd be worried about being the richest person in the room. And if there's somebody who's starting to get close to you, you want to do more and do more and, like, get more money so that you can continue to be the richest person. You cannot be that way without also being competitive with God, because he's like, pride is being competitive man to man, but it's also being competitive man to God. And you can see that people with a power complex often have, like, this God complex. Like, they actually think that they are better than everybody and that they should be able to tell everybody what to do. Man, we live in a proud world, don't we? Like, we see people like this all the time. And the thing is, as I read through, I was like, oh my gosh, I have so much pride.
Yes.
So much pride. Jeez. It was very humbling to read this chapter. And obviously, whenever we judge people, that is pride. And that's why I'm like, I feel like my main takeaway from this book is, like, don't judge people. Focus on improving yourself and your own journey, because soon as you're, like, doing anything outward other than trying to take care of people for the best reasons, you're off. And so
why are you trying to take care of people? Are you trying to take care of people because you care about the person, or because you want to be seen as somebody who is taking care of people?
Right. Exactly. Which and that can be pride too. There were a couple of things too that he said. There's some misunderstandings he wanted to guard against. He said, pleasure in being praised is not pride. The child who is patted on the back for doing a lesson well, the woman whose beauty is praised by her lover, the saved soul to whom Christ says, well done, are pleased and ought to be. But as soon as you start thinking, what a fine person I am to have done this, that's where the issue is. Instead of thinking, I'm so glad that I pleased that person. But if it begins instead with, like, oh yeah, like, I am pretty awesome, that is the issue. And then he says, we say in English, so this is number two thing that he wants to guard against. He says, we say in English that a man is proud of his son or his father or his school or regiment. And it may be asked whether pride in this sense is a sin. I think it depends on what exactly we mean by proud of, because if it just means you have a warm-hearted admiration for this thing, then that is not a sin at all. Of course, there's things that you have this admiration for, you have a love for. That's really what it means. You know, I'm proud of you, son. I admire your hard work. I admire the things that you're doing. That's very different. And then number three, he says, we must not think pride is something God forbids because he is offended at it, or that humility is something he demands as his due to his own dignity, as if God himself was proud. He wants you to know him and wants to give you himself. it's not like God himself needs us to be humble for his sake or not proud for his sake. We need to be humble for our own sakes, because if we are proud, we're not turning ourselves towards God at all. We're doing exactly the opposite. Fourth thing is, do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you that, of course, he is nobody. He will seem like a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. So a truly humble person is way more interested in the people around him than he is in himself.
If you meet someone who is humble, they won't be thinking about themselves at all. You kind of quoted it, but when it says he wants you to know him and wants to give you himself. And he and you are two things of such a kind that if you really get into any kind of touch with him, you will in fact be humble, delightedly humble, feeling the infinite relief of having for once got rid of all the silly nonsense about your own dignity, which has made you restless and unhappy all your life. So when we get to that point, it's like this relief. You don't have to worry about what other, you want to worry about what other people think, but not, it's a different worrying about what other people think. Like, you don't want to have to worry about what other people think of your status and you're like.
Yeah, because you're not in a competition.
Yes. Wouldn't that be like amazing to not be in a competition? Because I feel like I have a long ways to go.
And like, again, like I said, I read this chapter and I was like,
I'm constantly comparing myself to other people. My house isn't as clean. I'm not as skinny. I don't exercise as much. I don't cook as well, constantly comparing myself to other people.
Yeah.
And yeah. Pride could be thinking we're better, but could also be wanting to be better. Like feeling
in the wrong way. Yeah. Yeah.
Like feeling inferior, but yet wanting to be better.
Yeah. And sort of like putting ourselves down, because like it can be looking down on others. And I think it could also be looking down on ourselves, probably, huh?
Yeah. Just the want. So. Of being yeah. better than somebody else.
Right.
So
right.
Even if it's like where we're starting.
Yeah, that's true.
Fascinating. Okay.
I did love this part right here where it says, whenever we find that our religious life is making us feel that we are good, above all, that we are better than someone else, I think we may be sure that we are being acted on, not by God, but by the devil.
Is it called out?
Oh my gosh. But I think that it calls out many, many, many people, all of us, because how often do we go, well, they're nice, but they do this and this and this, it's bad. Or I would respect what she says, but she dresses this way. Or, you know, like, I don't know, which is like so lame that we do that.
When you have standards and things that, like we talked about this earlier in the book, when you have standards and things that you abstain from, you have to be careful to not think you're better than somebody because you abstain. But then at the same yes. time, other people think you think you're better because you abstain. But who knows what you think in your head, right?
Yeah. And that, again, it like goes back to like, it doesn't, we need to stop caring what other people really think and just worry about what God thinks. And we can't stop other people from judging us, but we can stop ourselves from judging other people. Right.
Pride is something I don't think about very much. So I liked that. So chapter 9 is about charity. So he talks about how there's 3 theological virtues, and they're faith, hope, and charity. And we hear about those all the time together. Charity is more than giving to the poor. He says, liking people makes it easier to have charity towards them. Yes, it does. It is easy to have charity towards people you like. 100%. He says, do not waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. Wow. And when you're behaving as if you loved somebody, then you will come to love them. And it's so true. I had this girl when I was in college that I was supposed to visit for church. And when they told me I was assigned to her, I was like, I cannot stand her. It was like her mannerisms that just like got on me. I went and started visiting her and I got to know her and I started to like her. And so like, the more you behave as if you love someone, you will come to love them. And he says, as Christians, if we try to treat everybody kindly, we will then like more people.
Yeah.
And then it'll be easier to have charity.
Yeah.
Good and evil. I wrote these in my own words. Good and evil both increase exponentially. And so I was telling my mom this and she was like, what does exponentially mean? And I was like, okay, math lesson really quick. But they do. So it compounds.
Yeah.
So like the more good we do and the more we try to, we just, those feelings will just come.
Yeah. And so it does. It becomes easier. It literally becomes easier.
Yes. And I think the true test is having charity towards those that we don't like. So that's the hard part. But he says, we are told that we are to love God. But what if we don't? He says, act as if you did. Oh my gosh. Ask yourself, if I were sure that I loved God, what would I do? And when you figure out the answer, go and do it. And then the last part of that chapter, he just kind of talks about if we're trying to do his will, then we are obeying his commandment. We just have to keep trying. I thought that chapter was amazing.
So a couple of things. He says, you behave like you love someone, you'll presently come to love him. Where if you injure someone you dislike, you will find yourself disliking him more. The two wolves, right? Whichever one you feed, that's the one that becomes the strongest. That's so if you do him a good turn, you will find yourself disliking him less. But it's kind of a warning. He says there is indeed one exception, because this goes back to pride. It does. If you do him a good turn, not to please God and obey the law of charity, but to show him what a fine, forgiving chap you are, and to put him in your debt and then sit down to wait for his gratitude, you'll probably be disappointed, because you're again trying to put yourself above him. You're being in competition. You're being like, see, look, I am actually better than you, because look what I just did. That is not charity.
Charity is without pride.
Without pride. Yeah. I just wanted to point that out. That
I'm glad he always says, like, you just have to keep trying, because this book makes me realize, gosh, I have a long ways to go.
But it kind of set, like, where are you, like, always trying to turn to? Which, that center of ourselves, are we trying to turn it towards God or turn it the opposite way? One teeny little baby step, like, at a time.
You don't just have to be good. You have to, like, have the intent to be good. You have to make sure you're not in competition with anybody. Like, run.
But you can see how, as you, like, gather all those things, it does change you.
Yeah. And we'll talk about this more. Like, you're feeling this way, and then I think the chapters in faith will make you realize, oh, good, we don't have to feel this way.
Yeah, that's really true. So chapter 10 is hope. And I loved this chapter. So my brief summary is that hope is just this sense that we innately have of something better. And because we're never quite satisfied on earth. And I don't think that that's to be mistaken for, like, covetousness or something, but, like, we have this sense that there's going to be something great and so good. And often we're kind of disappointed. Like, things turn out not as great as we thought. But he's like, the very fact that we have that sense of something better means that there probably is something better. And that something better is heaven. So he says that there's two wrong ways of dealing with this fact. The fact that we have this longing that fades away in reality. And there's one right way of dealing with this. He says the fool's way, he puts the blame on the things themselves. And they usually behave in very bad ways. They'll be like, oh, I was so in love with this person. And then we got married and became disenchanted. It must be something wrong with that person. So I'm going to try another person. Or I was so excited about this job. And then I got this job and it wasn't as great as I thought. So I'm going to try another job. It's like what we're talking about in Christian marriage. It's like, it's not actually the thing itself. It's just that those thrills do wear away. So you progress in other ways, and you don't blame the thing itself for the fact that it maybe wasn't as great as you were thinking. Because he's like, you're always going to be disappointed if you think that something is going to be as perfect, because nothing is perfect. So number two, the other wrong way of dealing with it, which he actually says is maybe an okay way. He says the way of the disillusioned, sensible man. He just decides that the whole thing was moonshine. You know, he watches young people and they're like so excited about stuff. He's like, well, they'll learn. Life is not that great. He says it tends to make him a prig. He rubs along fairly comfortably. It would be the best line we could take if man did not live forever. But supposing infinite happiness really is there waiting for us. So he says the Christian way, number three, which is the right way of dealing with this, is the Christian says creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. And so if the experience cannot be had in this world, then it must be in the next. And so that is our hope. Right? That's why we keep going and we keep trying, because we hope for more and for better. And again, not in a covetous way, but it's something that we are actively working for.
So that's my question. What do you hope heaven is like?
No sadness, no disappointments, no getting your hopes up and having them all crashed. Like, I don't know if that's a tall order or not, but
I want it to be restful.
Yeah, seriously. Plenty of sleep.
Yeah. And, like, my family around, and they don't make me mad.
I know. Having patience and no time constraints.
There you go. Bingo. No deadlines.
See, if you really think about it, like if we did not have any time constraints on anything, how much would that change our lives? You know?
I think that like they say, like, well, what if you knew that like the end was today or tomorrow? What would you do? And I was like, that is an unfair question because you can't do what you would do because then you would be homeless.
Exactly. That doesn't really work.
But like if there were no time constraints and you didn't have to earn money to live and eat and you could just do the things you want to do, spend time with the people you wanted to spend time with, I think that would just be heaven. Yeah, he just said, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. Probably earthly pleasures were not meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing.
I love that. And then continuing on a little later, he says, I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, which I shall not find till after death. I just thought that was so beautiful.
Oh, so good. I'm excited about it. Are you ready to go on? I'm excited about the faith chapters because I loved them. So there's I thought that was interesting when I was looking at it, that there was two chapters on faith. I was like, huh? Well, there's two kinds of faith. So the first kind of faith is belief. He says people think of faith as a virtue, which I kind of have thought of. Is virtue kind of like another word for like characteristic or commandment, kind of like things we should like have?
Good things that we're trying to obtain. Type of things. Yeah.
Okay. What is moral or immoral about believing or not believing a set of statements? Basically, I think of it as like, you know, somebody comes and tells you about Christ and like, there's really nothing moral, like, you know, I mean, you either believe it or you don't. Like, how is there something immoral or moral about that, right?
Right.
But he says the battle is between faith and reason on one side and emotion and imagination on the other side. And this was a little bit hard for me at first to like understand. I had to read it a few times, but I think this is what he's saying. If you at one time had decided that reason led you to believe, then there will come a time when your emotions will come up and you will decide that it's very convenient if Christianity weren't true. Something is going to happen to you and you're going to be like, it's going to be easy to talk yourself out of it because of your emotions and your imagination. And you're going to forget about the reason that you had before. Faith is holding on to things that you once thought reason gave evidence that Christianity was true.
Yeah. And like, despite your mood swings. Holding on even through your different feelings, your different moods, but you just keep holding on.
He says we have to train ourselves to not lose our belief when our moods change. And he says step one is recognizing that your moods will change. Yeah. And then we're supposed to make Christian doctrine part of our daily life. And he says that's why daily prayers and religious reading and church going are necessary parts of the Christian life because we have to be reminded every day. Otherwise, when these moods change, it will be easy to be like switch to thinking it's bogus or not true. And then step two is making a serious attempt to practice Christian virtues, not for a week. And I love that he says, but for like 6 weeks.
Yeah, try it for 6 weeks.
6 weeks? Okay. How about a lifetime? No. And then he says, we'll learn about ourselves. Okay. So he says, a silly idea that people have is that a good man doesn't know what temptation means and that only those trying to resist temptation know how strong it is. Duh.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that. Like when you just like let, you know, say you're trying to stop eating sugar and you just let yourself eat sugar, you don't give it time to like be a temptation. It's just like you just give in and it doesn't seem big. But when you're like trying to say, no, I'm not going to eat that, that temptation just grows and grows and grows and gets stronger.
But the thing is, it's kind of interesting because it does. It grows and grows and gets stronger and then it dies, right?
But you have that experience.
Yes, you have to have the experience where it becomes so strong that you're like not sure if you can overcome it, but then you do. To where it's not even a temptation.
And then he says, because Christ is the only man who never yielded to temptation, he's the only man that fully knows what temptation means. I never thought of that. Oh, yeah. He wasn't just like, oh, you know, temptation, like he was never tempted. I mean, we know he was, but I just kind of assumed it was like easy for him. Like,
I know, but it wasn't. Why would it be?
Yeah, at times it probably was easy, but sometimes it probably wasn't. So what we learn from a serious attempt to practice Christian virtues is that we fail. When we don't try, we don't fail because there's nothing hard in there. We're just like, whatever happens, fine. I'll just do whatever. There's no challenge in it. And then he just says, everything we have been given to us from God, if we devoted our whole lives to his service, we could not give him anything that wasn't already his. Wow. Like, I feel like that, like, never thought about before, but duh.
Yeah.
We can work and work and work and do everything we can. And it's like he gave the example of the father that, like, gave his son money to buy him a present. We're just giving back what he gave us. So,
yeah. Yeah. That was already his to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved that chapter. That was fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, and then one other thing he said, he talks about how, like, usually when Christians lose their belief, they drift away.
And that was tied into, like, the daily, you know, exposure yep. to scripture and prayer, religious readings and church going, all those necessary parts of life. And it's when people give those up that they drift away, because it's not that our faith is not fed. Okay, chapter 12 is also called faith because this is sort of another kind of faith, but I love how he leads out because he's like, there are a great many things that cannot be understood until after you have gone a certain distance along the Christian road. So he's like, if you're not a Christian and you're looking at this and you think that this cannot help you, then don't even read it because
it made me nervous.
I know. But it really hit home. And I think that for most people walking along a path of faith, they will absolutely understand what he's saying here because it really is about, what did I write? This faith is the sense of putting all our trust in God, basically getting to the point where you go, oh, actually, I can't do any of this. I need you. And understanding, of course, and he talks about how, like, this doesn't mean that we stop trying. That would be a complete antithesis to what he's saying here. It means that we keep working, understanding we have to put all of our trust in God and lean on him completely, hand it over to him. And I love this where he says,
this was a hard chapter, I think,
yes.
because it was so, there was so much.
Yes. But it really is this idea of that balance between action and putting all our trust in God. And he says, you know, some Christians dispute whether the thing that's going to get us home to God is good actions or faith in Christ. He's like, seems to me like that's asking which blade in a pair of scissors is most necessary. They totally work in tandem. Good actions done for that motive, done with the idea that heaven can be bought, would not be good actions at all, but only commercial speculations. He says the Bible helps us to understand. He says, work out it because it says in the Bible, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So we work as if everything depends on us. But it says, for it is God who worketh in you. So God does do everything and we don't actually do nothing. He says, I'm puzzled, but I'm not surprised. We do. We get up and we work as if everything depends on us, understanding that we cannot do anything without God. And I think when we have been, I think that's why he says, like, you're only going to understand this if you're sort of have, like, traveled for a while. And I think that anybody who's been through hard stuff understands this. And most people have been through hard stuff, that you do keep trying to work through the hard things, understanding, but also, like, handing it over to God and being like, please hold me through this because I can't do it without you. But you still, one day at a time, you just keep going, you know, and you look back and you go, how did I do that? And it's because he carries you.
So, like you said, it's not trying that is ever going to bring us home. All this trying leads up to the vital moment at which you turn to God and say, you must do this. I can't. I forget that. I'm so into doing things myself that I forget, yeah. Like, oh yeah, I could ask for help. Why haven't I? And I think, like, daily prayer is something that is so important and something I struggle with. And I think that once, I don't think there's a point where we get to where, oh, I've gotten to that level where I was reaching for, right? But then all along the way, there's like, oh, I'm not there yet. I don't think we'll ever get to where we think we are supposed to be. Well, we can't, because we can't do it on our own. And so realizing that is the key, realizing that you need Christ in your life. I also liked, it says, if you really handed yourself over to him, it must follow that you're trying to obey him. So, like you said, the two things go together, right? But trying in a new way a less worried way, not doing these things in order to be saved, but because he has begun to save you already.
Yeah.
Not hoping to get to heaven as a reward for your actions, but inevitably wanting to act in a certain way because a first faint gleam of heaven is already inside you.
And I do think that's probably where a lot have gone wrong over many years, is like trying to put this fear of hell into people or something to force them to behave themselves, instead of putting this hope of heaven, something that they want to get, and understanding that it is Christ who helps them get there. And so turning to him completely.
I know, it makes me excited for the next section, which is, what is the next section? Beyond personality or first steps in the doctrine of the Trinity. That sounds deep.
I know, that sounds really heavy. Okay. So, and we've got section 4 and section 5 left, right?
Just section 4.
Oh, just section 4. Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought there were 5 sections. All right. And this is a big section.
Yeah, another one.
It's a really big section. Rough.
Okay. So, yeah, next week we'll do book 4. And then we don't know. We're going to have an episode. The last episode of the year will be us talking about our favorite books of the year that we didn't read for the podcast. No. And then our first episode of 2024 will be us talking about what we're going to read for 2024. And we have no idea.
Man, that's really going to take us to the end. That's crazy.
We will. Okay. We'll know by the time we record. What have I been reading? I have to. Okay. I know what it is. Things You Save in a Fire by Catherine Center. I loved whatever that book was about the face blindness so much that I talked about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was called now. I loved her writing, and I was like, okay, I've got to pick up something else by her. So I just looked on Hoopla, and that was, it's a newer one, I think. I like it just as much as the other one, if not better. It's about a girl who's a firefighter, and something happens. She like lashes out at a congressman, and so she basically has to leave where she's working, and her mom is sick. Her mom tells her that she's going blind, and so she goes to live with her to take care of her. And her mom had left her, like abandoned her and her dad on her 16th birthday. Her mom had like left. And so she hadn't had a really good relationship with her. And so she goes to live with her and just gets to know her. She meets this guy at the new fire department that she's working at that she has loves, you know, immediately. She's like,
oh, falls in love.
Yes. Okay. It's very good. I really am enjoying it. I really like Catherine Sanders. That's her name.
So right? is she the same author?
Yeah.
That's the, okay.
Let me go look at what the other book was called. But our friend Carlina was asking me for books recommendation. She wanted something light and fluffy, right? But not, she said light and fluffy, but not a waste of time. And I was like, well, that's how I would describe Catherine Sanders. Like, I'm really enjoying it. And she's like, yeah, I've read everything by her. Hello, Stranger was the one I recommended a couple weeks ago. About the face blindness. And then this one is Things You Save in a Fire. And this one was available on Hoopla. I would suggest her, if you need something light and entertaining, but not a waste of time.
Yes, I love that.
Have you ever read her before?
No.
You should try her. See if you like it.
Yeah, I'm excited. I feel like my to-be-read list is so long.
Right.
The book that I'm listening to right now that I shared about last time, I'm still listening to it because it is very long and I just haven't had much time to listen. The Covenant of Water by Abraham Verghese. So I'm 13 hours into it, which means I've got 18 hours left and I've only got 4 days left. Can I do it? I don't know.
That would stress me out.
Yeah, I know. Because if I don't finish it, it could be months before I can. And it is really good. It's really good. So I would totally recommend. But the book I'm actually going to share this week is a children's book. And it's that I'm just about done reading with my kids right now. It's called The Red Pencil. And it's by Andrea Davis Pinkney. And I've always enjoyed her books. She's a good children's author. And it's the story of Amira, a 12-year-old Sudanese girl whose village is destroyed by the Janjaweed as part of the Darfur conflict. So Middle Eastern conflict, it's very sad and tragic. But also, you know, it's just so interesting to get this peek into their culture and their lives. I believe she's 12 and she does not know how to read or write. And that's something that she actually really wants to. And her dad actually wants to send her to school, but it is very traditional for women to not know how to read and write. And so her mother's like, no, you're not going to do that. But she aspires to go to school where she can learn to read and write. And among her numerous trials, she finds relief through her art. And she starts out like she just has this twig and she like draws pictures in the sand. And presumably she eventually is going to get a red pencil, but we're actually like almost, yeah, we're a good chunk into it. And she hasn't gotten that red pencil yet, but she has had a lot of hard things happen so far, but it is very good. And the interesting thing about it is that it's written in verse. It's not rhyming or anything. It's just unrhymed poetry, but it's very well done because sometimes you open those and you're like, how are my kids going to follow along with this, but they do. And so I feel like it's really good because they're getting an appreciation for the cadence of this beautiful poetry and sort of the repetition and alliteration and all the things you bring into poetry while also getting this beautiful story.
I don't think I've ever read anything in verse.
Again, like you can open them and be a little bit, it can, if you're not a poetry lover anyway, you might be like, but every book that I've read in verse, I've ended up just really loving. So it's worth a try. Maybe start with some children's books. Out of the Dust is written that way. This one's written that way. There's Red, White, and Whole that's written that way.
I was going to say, you said some really hard things have happened in her life. I'm like, yeah, she's waiting for a red pencil. If that isn't a clue.
Yep.
I'm looking around my room I'm sitting in and we sure take things for granted, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously.
My mom asked me if we had colored pencils and I was like, we have hundreds. Would you like?
Yeah.
Hundreds. And I can't bring myself to get rid of them. And I'm like, what is my problem? It's like a tub of just colored pencils.
It seems like that's what the kids love. Like, I have a box of crayons. Nobody touches the crayons, not even Cass. He way prefers markers or colored pencils over crayons.
Yeah. So I know Preston doesn't like crayons either. So I should just get rid of those maybe. But
yeah, I know. I'm like, I'm about an inch away from getting rid of them.
Yeah, exactly. Uses them,
which is sad. I'm like, I love crayons. They're so cool. We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss part 4 of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.